Now at McDonald's, get a $5 McChicken meal deal or a $6 McDouble meal deal. They come with small fries, a soft drink, and four-piece McNuggets. We're going to need a bigger tray. Get more value with your meal deal with McValue.
Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery.
Alive and kicking.
With Claire McKenna.
On News Talk.
Now, Marina Giblin is a senior portfolio manager at a financial firm and mother to her much-loved daughter, Elsie, who was born with additional needs. We often hear of the struggles for support and long waiting lists, inadequacies in our education system, societal and policy support. So what is the reality in the home when you're parenting and caring in the midst of all of this? Well, I'm delighted to say that Marina joins me in studio now. Marina, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Claire. Nice to be here.
We met at an event. We were on a panel together and we started chatting. And when you told me about Elsie in your life, I really thought this was something I wanted to cover on the show. Because as I say, it's something we don't hear enough about. The carers, who are these people and what kind of impact is it having on your life? So I'm so grateful for you to come and share something that I know is very personal to you. I find it difficult to talk about my own kids as they get older. So I really appreciate you coming in.
No, thank you. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be able to talk about it, to be fair. But I suppose I'd correct you on one thing.
Go on.
I don't see myself as Elsie's carer. I'm her mother. And most people in my position are mothers. And so you have a baby and you expect everything may be going all right. And then next thing you know, you have this baby that's special in different ways. And you don't plan for that at all. But as a mother, you know, you do what every other mother does. And so you try to navigate the world for your daughter or your son in the best way you can. But when you have a child like Elsie, and I like to call her exceptional because she's exceptional, she's different in some ways, you shouldn't have to take on the world to find her place in the world. And that to me has been eye-opening. I might have been naive because Elsie's condition has no name. So I thought, oh, this is great. Nobody can put a label on her. But then the world we live in, everyone wants a label. So you fight that first and then you take it from there.
And I really appreciate the correction. I'm always on for correction and learning. And it is an important distinction. And I want to ask you about terminology, because even when I was writing that introduction, I wondered how best to describe Elsie. And I said additional needs. We hear special needs. How do you feel about the term disability? Because we talk a lot about disability rights, and I have an issue now with disability. I think it's already starting on a negative about that person.
Well, I suppose if you take it right back to Ireland's historical past and the treatment of people that were vulnerable, we have a very sordid past. Like, basically, people were institutionalised, they were segregated. Most of the help or support that was given was charity-based. They were viewed as people to be pitied. They were viewed, you know, that they were separate from society. And a lot of that legacy is still there. So there, that's where the terminology comes. Like, Elsie's my daughter. That's it. Simple. And she sees that as herself. She's Elsie, and she doesn't see herself as any different than any other daughter. And she navigates life as best she can. She has a huge acceptance of her abilities that she needs help with and support with. And she knows she needs help and support. And that's not a surprise. But then she looks at me and she'll say, oh, well, you have this. And she looks at somebody else and she'll say, you have this. And if you look around you, everybody has something that differentiates them and they're different. But society, and somebody very wise said to me once, society is a little bit about crowd control. And if your child doesn't fit into a crowd, then that's where the situation starts. And, you know, we always talk about diversity and inclusion, and there's a lot of work done around, you know, all the people that are different. And my daughter is a little bit different, and that should be celebrated because differences add flavour. And why should it be so difficult to find her place in society to be included? And that's the way I view it. So the terminology kind of is people's discomfort with difference rather than correct or incorrect. And I've had people say different things to me, or I've been out with her and some old lady will come up and bless her and say, oh, I hope she gets better soon. And I just let it go because, like, Elsie doesn't need to get better. She is who she is. And if we could accept people for who they are, then the world would be a lot of an easier place to navigate.
And can you take me back to when Elsie was born? Because I imagine there was a lot of labelling and terminology that you had to get your head around with your new little baby in your arms.
Well, she was born in 2004. And my first child, my only child, and I didn't know I was, like, she was 9 pounds 7, big baby. And I had no idea that there may be, you know, something that might differentiate Elsie. And they said to me, she was an emergency C-section. And they said to me, oh, she's a bit floppy. And I thought, okay, well, aren't all babies floppy? Because, you know, I didn't know that they weren't floppy. And then she had some breathing difficulties and they took her to the NICU. And then I was kind of in the hospital there with no baby for a week. And it was the depth of winter, it was November. And then they did some tests and they came back with this very rare condition. There's only 1 in 40,000 people are born with it. And they didn't really know much. And they didn't know what her life would entail. They didn't know anything really. And while I was in the hospital, I met another lady who had a baby who was in NICU. And we would meet for coffee every day. And her baby was right beside Elsie. And we made a lifelong friendship from that week we spent together in the coom. And it really helped me navigate the early years because we both had babies. We both didn't know where their lives would turn. But we had the support of each other. And you find when you have a new baby that everybody's like, oh, they're so cute. Oh, they're beautiful. So I really didn't tell anybody that there was, you know, reason to be concerned about Elsie's future or how she would develop or anything for the first few months. And it was really important for me to have those first few months where people would just look into the pram and think, oh, isn't she just a beautiful baby? And I then eventually, you know, Elsie didn't meet her milestones, her developmental milestones physically. So she didn't sit up when she should. So then at that point, after the first 3 months where I got used to the fact that my beautiful baby was a little bit different, I then started basically finding her all the help I could to help her meet her milestones. And that helped me then hugely because I felt that I was doing my best for her. So we started with, I think it was a Ukrainian lady used to come around and plop her up on the kitchen table and give her a full body massage when she was about 3 months old because she was hypotonia. She had hypotonia, which is low muscle tone.
And how much support was there? Because you mentioned when we first started talking about having to fight a lot of the time. And parenting is hard. It's a lot. And trying to, you know, juggle a working life and family life is difficult enough without trying to take on the lack of policy and support and the education system. That's hard and it's sad. Again, we come back to terminology and language being powerful. When it feels like a fight and a struggle, when did that first become apparent?
Well, I suppose in the early years, to stay working was very important financially because that gives you choices. And it also helps you maintain who you are as a person. So you have a life outside being a mother to an exceptional child. So to juggle that and to, you know, to be able to do that and stay working to give you the financial choices that you need is difficult because with a baby that has additional needs, you know, whether it be feeding or developmental delay, you can't just put them into a creche because they won't survive because nobody's going to spend 3 hours giving them a bottle. So that was never an option for early childcare. So then, you know, you have to try and source support. So I always, from the very beginning, felt that we needed support. And, you know, financially, because I was working, I was able to pay for that support. But what I'd really like to see is, you know, people who need those additional needs from the early stages be identified and a social worker assigned at birth. And then, you know, your benefits that you're entitled to made clear to you not to have to go searching around for them. And then a personalised budget that you can hire additional support and help into the home to help you and give you the opportunity then to continue to work. And there's debate around carer's allowance being means tested. There's a lot of debate, but very little action, if I'm honest. And there's been a lot of legislation, particularly around, you know, I mean, the Epson Act hasn't still been ratified, which was introduced the year Elsie was born, and she's 21 going on 22. You know, the Assisted Decision Making Act was brought forward in 2015, and it's only now coming into, you know, fruition. There's no adult safeguarding legislation. So there's a lot of talk, and there's a review of the Disability Act from 2005, and they want input. I mean, to be fair, what input do you need? The results are there to see. So it's, you know, you can talk all you want, but unless you take action and look for solutions, what's the point in talking?
What difference would that have made to Elsie's life if they had ratified the EPSON Act in 2004?
So we lived in a little area in Dublin 8, lovely little neighbourhood. And in the early years, Elsie got preschool with Enable Ireland. And they were, I mean, unbelievable. And so I was very lucky. I was actually very lucky that she didn't walk till she was six, because that's how I got her into Enable Ireland. So I always looked at the things she could do and not what she couldn't do. But to access services, you have to actually find a label to put her on. So she wasn't walking at six. So I went to Enable Ireland. I said, look, she's a physical disability. She's not walking. So I got her into the preschool there. And that was life changing, because she got all the therapeutic interventions that she needed early. And then when it came to school time, there was a lovely little national school at the end of our street. And she got a place there. And it opened up our lives, because one of the things I find really emotional and difficult is I always wanted to walk Elsie to school. And you see parents, that's the biggest privilege you can have for your child, to walk her to school. And that happened for us for a very short period of time. She went to the mainstream school at the end of the street. We used to walk her to school. I just loved that. But it didn't last long. And we met our neighbours in the area, and they're still lifelong friends. Elsie made friends. But then the support just wasn't there. And I can't blame the school. At the time I did, because I was naive. But, you know, having a support for Elsie just to kind of babysit her in class isn't enough. They needed to bring the occupational therapist, the speech therapist. They needed the teachers to be fully trained, you know, to integrate somebody that has different challenges in the classroom. In a large classroom of like 26 people, they need an individual education plan, which isn't enforceable under the EPSON Act because it hasn't been, you know, it hasn't been ratified. They needed, you know, a special statement of educational assessment to show what she needed to be able to be part of a mainstream, which the word mainstream I hate as well, classroom. And none of those were there for her. So she got to, she went in as a frail little 5 or 6 year old in a walker. And by the time she got to third class, she was a big girl, and they just, you know, behaviour, her behaviours, her means of communication, that was seen as a negative because she was overwhelmed and she wasn't properly supported. So then our only option then was either she gets expelled from school, and at like 10, you don't really want your child expelled from school. So we had to look for a special school. And then she's segregated and not included, and I couldn't get to walk her to school.
And I'm having so many moments of insight from what you're saying, and I hate the word mainstream now as well. What on earth does that even mean? Yeah. And when we talk about neurodivergence, which we're talking about a lot more now, when we talk about the current system looks after one way of learning, and if we changed it to bring in neurodivergent, those with additional needs, every unique person, it would benefit all.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's only benefiting one way and leaving out other ways. But if we changed it, it would actually benefit everybody. Because for Elsie and other kids like Elsie to be included in a classroom, that benefits everybody. And that means then in the workplace, that's becomes the norm. In society, that becomes the norm. In communities, that becomes the norm.
It all starts with education. You know, if you don't start it early, how can you change your society? And how can, you know, you create an environment where, and the little friends Elsie met who are now in their 20s, they are Elsie's friends, and she has had them all her life. And they're all different in different ways. Everybody is. And as you say correctly, our education system is just about a small few. And that's why, you know, we've, since COVID, I suppose, there's been a lot of issues with young people with anxiety. It's not catering for anybody. And, you know, you cater for the few, but you lose the most of the people that really make up our society and make it different and make us unique and give us different ways of thinking and approaching things and approaching people and value of people, where they, you know, you value their differences rather than you segregate their differences.
How has this impacted you and your life?
That's an interesting question. I suppose it's given me, I was one of those lucky few that probably was a mainstream education person. Like, education came easy to me. My exams came easy to me. Most things in life, you know, came easy. So I didn't, in hindsight, have the appreciation that I have for people that things don't come easy to. And had I not had my daughter, I don't think I ever would have that eye-opening moment. So I have immeasurable patience now, which I have to have. But I do get jaded and I get tired. And I always say to people that you can't be everything to everybody. And we have had and always have support at home. And we have carers that come in, and Elsie knows that she needs support. So when Elsie has support, then I have time to be me and to be here talking to you and to work. And then, you know, I'm lucky I have a supportive employer. So they give me that flexibility to, you know, to be me and to also care for Elsie. And that's really important. So I see how this has impacted me in only positive ways. I was never one for like, oh, poor me, because it's not poor you. It enhances your life and changes your life immeasurably, and gives you, you know, different ways of looking for solutions to different problems. And so I think that I wouldn't change one bit of it.
And what a gift, again, that would be for fellow classmates to learn by sharing a room and a life with Elsie, as you have. How is Elsie now, today?
Well, she's a complete character. She, thankfully, to her little brief period in mainstream school, she's unbelievably with literacy. So I get literal text messages, updates of everything. So what time the carer arrives, what time, what she did, what she didn't do. She loves to write stories. So it gives me great comfort because she can communicate with me what's happening. And she wants to know the ins and outs of everything. She's nosy, which is great. She loves life. She describes herself as an adult doll collector. So we spend a lot of time in toy shops, and her big wish is to actually get a little part-time job in a toy shop. But again, she needs support to do that. So we've visited a few local toy shops. She's done an interview in her own head, and when they asked her why she wanted to work in a toy shop, she said it was her lifelong dream. She knows she needs support to be there, but it's just, you know, getting the opportunity for her. It's really, really, really difficult.
And you were telling me this previously on one of our phone chats, and she'd be a great employee. You said if you're there in the toy shop with her, she'll go over and advise, you know, parents of other families and kids about which toy they should get and which would suit them, because she knows this so well.
Yeah.
And she's helped make sales.
She has. The first thing she'll say is, Mom, how old is she? So I have to actually introduce myself to complete strangers and then ask how old their children are. And then they'll say, oh, she's six, it's her birthday. And then Elsie will ask, are you into Barbies? And if they're not, then she'll, you know. So we spend quite a bit of time in toy shops meeting people and, you know, selling toys on behalf of the toy shop. And then, of course, buying toys, because she'll say to me, oh, Mom, please, can I have that? And then she'll go, you'll never retire. So... that's her. She absolutely loves toys, yeah.
Well, any wish I get, be it blown a dandelion or a candle, I'm going to be wishing for Elsie to get that job, a part-time job in a toy shop and make her dream come true.
Thank you.
Do you still worry for her future?
I do, yeah, I really do, because Elsie will need support for the rest of her life. Because she has abilities, you take her to an environment that's a segregated, disability-focused, you know, residential or whatever. And I've had a couple of experiences and they'll say, oh, no, she's not for us, she's complex. And I'm like, can you describe what complex means? Is it complex because she has abilities and will be able to advocate for herself and then she won't do what you want her to do and she won't be compliant because she is an adult? Or is she complex that you feel you can't support her? You don't really get a good answer to that one. So we're at the point now where, you know, I'm getting older. Elsie's, you know, getting older. And we're, you know, worrying about when we're not here. And I think it's a really common problem. There's been groups set up for people in Ireland that are still, you know, parents to young people that are in their 30s and 40s. And there's no provision being made as to what happens when those parents pass. And I'm at that point now. I'm trying to forward plan for Elsie, for her future, so that she can live her full life. And she describes her adulthood as happy, loves life. And I want that to continue. I want her to live as long and full and as happy life as I have. But she needs support to do that.
Well, I'll be adding a list of wishes for Elsie and other people like her. And back to the language, we seem to be more about crowd control than true inclusion. Yeah. And that's the biggest wish. Marina, thank you so much. I knew this would be an important conversation, but it's really blown me away. Marina Giblin, Senior Portfolio Manager and mother to Elsie. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Claire.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.